condition my mind to stop putting the blame on external forces. I had to educate myself, get rid of some baggage. The solitude of time was what I didn't have. Whatever the counterculture was, I'd seen enough of it. I was sick of the way my lyrics had been extrapolated, their meaning subverted into polemics, and that I had been anointed as the Big Bubba of rebellion, high priest of protest, the czar of dissent, the duke of disobedience, leader of the freeloaders, kaiser of apostasy, archbishop of anarchy, the big cheese. What the hell are we talking about? Horrible titles any way you want to look at it. All code words for outlaw. It was tough moving around, like the Merle Haggard song. I'm on the run, the highway is my home. I don't know if Haggard ever had to get his family out with him, but I know I did. It's a little different when you have to do that. The landscape burned behind us. The press was in no hurry to retract their judgment, and I just couldn't lie there. Had to take the bull by the horns myself and remodel the image of me. Change the perception of it anyway. There aren't any rules to cover an emergency of this kind. This was a new thing for me, and I wasn't used to thinking this way. I'd have to send out deviating signals, crank up the wrecking train, create some different impressions. At first, I was only able to do little things, local things, tactics, really. Unexpected things like pouring a bottle of whiskey over my head and walking into a department store and act pie-eyed, knowing that everyone would be talking amongst themselves when I left. I was hoping that the news would spread. What mattered to me most was getting breathing room for my family. The whole spectral world could go to hell. My outer image would have to be something a bit more confusing, a bit more humdrum. It's hard to live like this. It takes all your effort. The first thing that has to go is any form of artistic self-expression that's dear to you. Art is unimportant next to life, and you have no choice. I had no hunger for it anymore anyway. Creativity has much to do with experience, observation, and imagination, and if any one of those key elements is missing, it doesn't work. It was impossible now for me to observe anything without being observed. In Woodstock, I'd be out in the yard and a car would come rolling up. Some guy would jump out of the passenger side, point in my direction and walk away, and a bunch of sightseers would then come down the hill. My house was being battered, ravens constantly croaking ill omens at our door. What kind of alchemy, I wondered, could create a perfume that would make a reaction to a person lukewarm, indifferent, apathetic? I wanted to get some. I had never intended to be on the road of heavy consequences, and I didn't like it. I wasn't the toastmaster of any generation, and that notion needed to be pulled up by its roots. Liberty for myself and my loved ones had to be secured. I had no time to kill, and I didn't like what was being thrown at me. This main meal of garbage had to be mixed up with some butter and mushrooms, and I'd have to go to great lengths to do it. You gotta start somewhere. I went to Jerusalem, got myself photographed at the Western Wall wearing a skullcap. The image was transmitted worldwide instantly, and quickly all the great rags changed me overnight into a Zionist. This helped a little. Coming back, I quickly recorded what appeared to be a country western record and made sure it sounded pretty bridled and housebroken. The music press didn't know what to make of it. I used a different voice, too. People scratched their heads. I started a rumor with my record company that I would be quitting music and going to college, the Rhode Island School of Design. Stories were printed about me trying to find myself, that I was on some eternal search, that I was suffering some kind of internal torment. It all sounded good to me. I released one album, a double one, where I just threw everything I could think of at the wall and whatever stuck, released it, and then went back and scooped up everything that didn't stick and released that, too. I missed out on Woodstock, just wasn't there. Altamont, Sympathy for the Devil, missed that too. Eventually, I would even record an entire album based on Chekhov short stories. Critics thought it was autobiographical. That was fine. I played a part in a movie, wore cowboy duds, and galloped down the road. Not much required there, I guess I was naive. The novelist Herman Melville's work went largely unnoticed after Moby Dick. Critics thought that he crossed the literary line and recommended burning Moby Dick. By the time of his death, he was largely forgotten. I had assumed that when critics dismissed my work, the same thing would happen to me, that the public would forget about me. How mad is that? Eventually, I would have to face the music, go back to performing, the long-awaited Ballyhooed reunion tour, gypsy tours, changing ideologies like tires, like shoes, like guitar strings. What's the difference? As long as my own form of certainty stayed intact, I owed nobody nothing. I wasn't going to go deeper into the darkness for anybody. I was already living in the darkness. My family was my light, and I was going to protect that light at all cost. That was where my dedication was, first, last, and everything in between. What did I owe the rest of the world? Nothing. Not a damn thing. The press? I figured you'd lie to it. For the public eye, I went into the bucolic and mundane as far as possible. In my real life, I got to do the things that I loved best, and that was all that mattered. The Little League games, birthday parties, taking my kids to school, camping trips, boating, rafting, canoeing, fishing. I was living on record royalties. In reality, I was imperceptible. My image, that is. Sometime in the past, I had written and performed songs that were most original and most influential. And I didn't know if I ever would again, and I didn't care. Archibald MacLeish's play Scratch has a couple of characters, one of them whose name was in the title of the play. Scratch utters the lines, "I know there is evil in the world, essential evil, not the opposite of good or the defective of good, but something to which good itself is an irrelevance, a fantasy." From there on, it only gets better. Writing songs for a play wouldn't have been far-fetched for me, and I already composed a couple of things for him just to see if I could do it. I always liked the stage, and even more so the theater. My first appearances in a public spectacle had been on my hometown school auditorium stage. No small music box theater, but a professional concert hall, like Carnegie Hall built with East Coast mining money, with curtains and props, trapdoors, and orchestra pit. My first performances were seen in the Black Hills Passion Play of South Dakota, a religious drama depicting the last days of Christ. This play always comes to town during the Christmas season with professional actors in the leading roles, cages of pigeons, a donkey, a camel, a truck full of props. There were always parts that called for extras. One year I played a Roman soldier with a spear and a helmet, breastplate, the works, a non-speaking role, but it didn't matter. I felt like a star. I liked the costume. It felt like a nerve tonic. As a Roman soldier, I felt like a part of everything in the center of the planet, invincible. That seemed a million years ago now, a million private struggles and difficulties ago. I wasn't feeling so invincible at the moment. Defiant, maybe. Anything but content. Surrounded on all sides. As far as I could see, nothing was visible. Nothing but my own kitchen. Nothing but the hot dogs with the English muffins and noodles. The Cheerios and cornflakes with heavy cream. Stirring flour into a large bowl for corn pudding and beating eggs, changing diapers and making bottles. Somehow between all that and maneuvering unmolested through the neighborhood and taking the dog for a walk, I'd gone to the piano, composed a few things for MacLeish's play, bearing in mind the titles that were given to me. I had gone to New York earlier in the week and met with the play's producer, Stuart Ostro. I'd taken songs up to his office in the Brill Building in New York and recorded them. He then sent the acetates to Archie. While in New York, my wife and I went to the Rainbow Room on top of Rockefeller Center to see Frank Sinatra Jr., who was singing with a full orchestra. Why him and not somebody on the hip circuit? No hassles and nobody chasing me, that's why. That, maybe because I felt a connection. I reckoned that we were about near the same age and that he was a contemporary of mine. Anyway, Frank was a fine singer. I didn't care if he was as good as his old man or not. He sounded fine, and I liked his big blasting band. Afterwards, he came by and sat with us at our table. Obviously, it had surprised him that someone like me would come see him. But when he saw that I genuinely liked the show tunes, he eased up and relaxed. Said he liked a few of my songs, Blowin' in the Wind and Don't Think Twice. Asked me questions about what kind of places I played. I was retired and lived like a hermit, but didn't say that. He asked about the civil rights movement. Said his father had been active in civil rights and had always fought for the underdog. Said that his father felt like he was one himself. Frank Jr. seemed pretty smart. Nothing faked or put on or ritzy about him. There was a legitimacy about what he did, and he knew who he was. The conversation rolled along. "How do you think it would make you feel," he said, "to find out that the underdog had turned out to be a son of a bitch?" "I don't know," I said. "Probably not so good." Gazing out through the wall of windows, you could see the spectacular city view. From 60 floors up, it was a different world. After a while, I bought a red flower for my wife, one of the loveliest creatures in the world of women, and we got up on our feet and left, said goodbye to Frank. A reply from MacLeish eventually arrived, and he had some questions. I knew he would. He invited me to come back up to his place. We could tune up the compositions, integrate them, and talk about them further. With little hesitation, I jumped behind the wheel of our long four-door Ford station wagon sedan and headed up again across the New England countryside. Even behind the wheel, with my eyes on the open road, I couldn't keep the clanging reverberations out of my mind. I felt like a caged bird, like a refugee, zigzagging up the winding highways. Felt like someone who was transporting a corpse across state lines and could be pulled over at any time. I clicked on the radio. Johnny Cash was singing Boy Named Sue. Once upon a time, Johnny had shot a man in Reno just to watch him die. Now he was saying that he was stuck with the girl's name that his father had given him. Johnny was trying to change his image, too. Aside from that, I didn't see much similarity between my situation and anybody else's. Felt pretty isolated with just myself and my small but growing family facing a fantastic world of sorcery. After a while, I cruised into Massachusetts and arrived again at Archie's. Archie walked into the room and greeted me warmly. It was like seeing an old friend, and I wondered if he was going to touch on serious topics again, but he didn't want to make chit-chat. He wondered why the songs weren't darker than they were, and he made suggestions. I felt myself sitting there and degenerating into boorishness. Felt like two parts of myself were beginning to battle. I wanted to tell him things were muddled, that a mob had been surrounding our house with bullhorns and calling on me to come out into the streets and lead a march on City Hall, on Wall Street, on the Capitol. That mythological figures of the fates had been weaving and now cutting my thread of life. That there were 100,000 demonstrators in Washington and the police have surrounded the White House with transport buses bumper to bumper to protect the executive mansion. The president was inside watching a football game. People I've never heard of were calling for me to be there and take command. It was all making me want to throw up. In my dreams, crowds were chanting, challenging me, shouting, "Follow us and fit in!" I wanted to tell him that life itself has turned into a prowling lion. I wanted to tell him that I needed to escape the blaze of bullshit. Deep down, I knew that I couldn't have anything to add to the message of his play. He didn't need my help anyway. He wanted only to talk about the songs for his play, and that's why I was here. But there was no hope and there was nothing to be done, and soon that became obvious. The sun had set and the solemn night was establishing itself. I was asked to stay for dinner, but politely declined. He'd been patient with me. Suddenly on my way out, my mind sprang back to another time, the time I'd seen the leopard girl. Sometimes you just think of things you've seen, old memories that you've salvaged from the rubble of your life. The leopard girl. A carny barker had explained about her, how her mother, who was pregnant with her in North Carolina, saw a leopard on the dark road at night, and the animal had marked her unborn child. Then I saw the leopard girl, and when I did, my emotions got weak. I wondered now whether all of us, McLeish, me, everyone else, had been inscribed and marked before birth, given a sticker, some secret sign. If that's true, then none of us could change anything. We're all running a wild race. We play the game the way it's set up, or we don't play. It was time to go. I asked him, just out of curiosity, why he hadn't wanted to write the songs himself. He said he wasn't a songwriter and that his play needed another voice, another angle. That sometimes we become too content. Archie's play was so heavy, so full of midnight murder. There was no way I could make its purpose mine. But it was great meeting him, a man who had reached the moon when most of us scarcely made it off the ground. In some ways, he taught me how to swim the Atlantic. I wanted to thank him, but found it difficult. We waved at each other from the roadway, and I knew I'd never see him again. Bob Johnston, my record producer, was on the line. He was calling me from Nashville and had reached me in East Hampton. We were living in a rented house on a quiet street with majestic old elms, a colonial house with plantation-shuttered windows. It was hidden from the street by elevated hedges. There was a large backyard and a key to a gated dune which led to the pristine Atlantic sandy beach. I started painting landscapes there. There was plenty to do. We had 5 kids and often went to the beach, boated on the bay, dug for clams, spent afternoons at the lighthouse near Montauk, went to Gardner's Island, hunted for Captain Kidd's buried treasure, rode bikes, go-karts, pulled wagons, went to the movies and the outdoor markets, walked around on Division Street, drove over to Springs a lot, a painter's paradise where de Kooning had his studio. We had rented the house under my mother's maiden name and had no trouble getting around. My face wasn't that well known, although the name would have made people uncomfortable. Earlier in the week, we had gotten back from Princeton, New Jersey, where I had been given an honorary doctorate degree. It had been a weird adventure. Somehow, I motivated David Crosby to come along. Crosby was part of a new supergroup, but I knew him from when he was in the Byrds, part of the West Coast music scene. They'd recorded a song of mine, Mr. Tambourine Man, and the record made it to the top of the charts. Crosby was a colorful and unpredictable character. wore a mandrake, the magician cape, didn't get along with too many people and had a beautiful voice, an architect of harmony. He was tottering on the brink of death even then, and could freak out a whole city block all by himself, but I liked him a lot. He was out of place in the Byrds. He could be an obstreperous companion. We pulled off Route 80 in a 69 Buick Electra, found the university in a hot and cloudless day. In short time, the officials led me into a crowded room and put me in a robe, and soon I was looking out over a crowd of well-dressed people in the sun. There were also others on the stage getting honorary degrees, and I needed mine as much as they needed theirs, but for different reasons. Walter Lippmann, the liberal columnist, Coretta Scott King, some others, but all eyes were on me. I stood there in the heat staring out at the crowd, daydreaming, had attention span disorder. When my turn came to accept the degree, the speaker introducing me said, "Though he is known to millions, he shuns publicity and organizations, preferring the solidarity of his family and isolation from the world. And though he is approaching the perilous age of 30, he remains the authentic expression of the disturbed and concerned conscience of young America." Oh, sweet Jesus, it was like a jolt. I shuddered and trembled but remained expressionless. The disturbed conscience of young America? There it was again. I couldn't believe it. Tricked once more. The speaker could have said many things. He could have emphasized a few things about my music. When he said to the crowd that I preferred isolation from the world, it was like he told them that I preferred being in an iron tomb with my food shoved in on a tray. The sunlight was blocking my vision, but I could still see the faces gawking at me with such strange expressions. I was so mad I wanted to bite myself. Lately, the public perception of me had begun to shift and move around like a yo-yo, but this kind of thing could set it back 1,000 years. Didn't they know what was happening? Even the Russian newspaper Pravda had called me a money-hungry capitalist. Even the Weathermen, a notorious group who made homemade bombs in basements to blow up public buildings, who had taken their name from a line in one of my songs, had recently changed their name from the Weathermen to the Weather Underground. I was losing all kinds of credibility. There were all kinds of things going on. I was glad I came to get the degree, though. I could use it. Every look and touch and scent of it spelled respectability and had something of the spirit of the universe in it. After whispering and mumbling my way through the ceremony, I was handed the scroll. We piled back into the big Buick and drove away. It had been a strange day. "Bunch of dickheads on auto stroke," Crosby said. Bob Johnston asked over the phone if I was thinking about recording. Of course I was. As long as my records were still selling, why wouldn't I be thinking about recording? I didn't have a whole lot of songs, but what I did have were the McLeish pieces, and I figured I could add to them, make up more in the studio if I had to, and Johnston was raring to go. Working with him was like a drunken joyride. Al Cooper played on some of my best records, so I asked Johnston to call him. That was my only suggestion to Johnston as to who to book. Within a week, I was in the New York Columbia studios with Johnston at the helm, and he's thinking that everything I'm recording is fantastic. He always does. He's thinking that something's going to strike pay dirt, that it's totally together. On the contrary, nothing was ever together. Not even after a song had been finished and recorded was it ever together. From one of these sets of lyrics, Al Cooper played some Teddy Wilson riffs on the piano. There were three girl singers in the room, who sounded like they'd been plucked from a choir, and one of them did some improvisational scat singing. The whole thing was done in just one take and called "If Dogs Run Free." I recorded some of the earlier stuff from the McLeish play that did have melodies, and that seemed to go well. Whatever else fit, fragments, tunes, offbeat phrases, didn't matter. My reputation was firm in hand, at least these songs wouldn't make any gory headlines. Message songs, there weren't any. Anybody listening for them would have been disappointed, as if I was going to make a career out of that anyway. Regardless, you could still feel the anticipation in the air. When will the old hymn be back? When will the door burst open and the goose appear? Not today. I felt like these songs could blow away in cigar smoke, which suited me fine. That my records were still selling surprised even me. Maybe there were good songs in the grooves, and maybe there weren't, who knows? But they weren't the kind where you hear an awful roaring in your head. I knew what those kinds of songs were like, and these weren't them. It's not like I hadn't any talent, I just wasn't feeling the full force of the wind. No stellar explosions. I was leaning against the console and listening to one of the playbacks. It sounded okay. Johnston had asked me earlier, "What do you think you'll call this record?" Titles? Everybody likes titles. There's a lot to be said in the title. I didn't know, though, and hadn't thought about it. But one thing I did know was that there'd be a photo of me and Victoria Spivey on the cover. The photo had been taken a few years earlier in a small recording studio. I knew that this photo would be on the cover even before I recorded the songs. Maybe I was even making this record because I had a cover in mind and needed something to go on the sleeve. It could be. Down and out on the scene, how does that sound? Johnson stared at me and made out of it what he would. Oh shit, that's gonna defang 'em all. I didn't know who them all were that he was referring to. Probably the executives at Columbia Records. He thought of them as a bunch of rattlesnakes. I gazed around the room, got up and nervously paced around a few times. Watched the clock on the wall. It seemed to be running backwards. I sat back down, feeling lines plowing into my face and the whites of my eyes turning yellow. Al Cooper was clowning around, telling shaggy dog stories. I was listening to Charlie Daniels practicing scales on the fiddle, thumbing through some of the magazines that were left on the table, running across an article in Mail magazine about a guy, James Lally, a radio man in World War II who had crashed with his pilot in the Philippines. I got sidetracked for a second. It was a gut-crunching article, unfiltered. Armstrong, the pilot, was killed in the crash, but Lally was taken prisoner by the Japanese, who took him to a camp and beheaded him with a samurai sword, and then used his head for bayonet practice. I pushed the magazine away. Russ Kunkel, the drummer on the sessions, was sitting on a couch with his eyes halfway shut, tapping two sticks together, gazing through the glass darkly. I couldn't stop thinking about Lally and felt like moaning in the wind. Buzzy Featon, one of the guitar players, was laying the groundwork for a tune maybe we'd cut tomorrow or the next day or maybe never get to at all. Johnston came in, cheerful as always. I had just heard the song New Morning on the playback and thought it had come out pretty good. New Morning might make a good title. I thought and then said it to Johnston. Man, you were reading my mind. That'll put 'em in the palm of your hand. They'll have to take one of them mind training courses that you do while you sleep to get the meaning of that. Exactly. And I would have to take one of them mind-reading courses to know what Johnston meant by saying what he just said. It didn't matter. I knew where Bob must have gotten that from, though. I'd brought a book, Secret of Mind Power by Harry Lorraine, to the studio, and had left it laying on one of the couches. I thought that the book might help me to continue freeze-framing my image, help me learn how to suggest only shadows of my possible self. Harry Lorraine, however, was no match for Machiavelli. A few years earlier, I'd read The Prince, and I'd liked it a lot. Most of what Machiavelli said made sense, but certain things stick out wrong. Like when he offers the wisdom that it's better to be feared than loved. It kind of makes you wonder if Machiavelli was thinking big. I know what he meant, but sometimes in life, someone who is loved can inspire more fear than Machiavelli ever dreamed of. The record that we were working on was eventually indeed called New Morning, the title of one of the songs I'd composed for the MacLeish play, and it did have the photo of me and Vicky on it. The 12-song record was released and the flow of reports came streaming in. Some critics would find the album to be lackluster and sentimental, soft in the head. Oh well. Others would triumph it as finally the old hymn is back. At last. That wasn't saying much either. I took it all as a good sign. To be sure, the album itself had no specific resonance to the shackles and bolts that were strapping the country down. Nothing to threaten the status quo. All this was in what the critics would later refer to as my middle period. And in many camps, this record was referred to as a comeback album. And it was. It was the first of many. Oh Mercy. It was 1987, and my hand, which had been ungodly injured in a freak accident, was in the state of regeneration. It had been ripped and mangled to the bone and was still in the acute stage. It didn't even feel like it was mine. I didn't know what had befallen me, and this was a bizarre shift of fate. All potentialities had gone to pieces. With 100 show dates scheduled for me starting in the spring, it was uncertain that I would be able to perform. It was now only January, but my hand was going to need plenty of time to heal and be rehabilitated. Staring out French windows into an overgrown garden, with a cast on my hand that went nearly to my elbow, I realized that my playing days might well have faded out. The public has been fed a steady diet of my complete recordings on disc for years, but my live performances never seemed to capture the inner spirit of the songs, had failed to put the spin on them. The intimacy, among a lot of other things, was gone. For the listeners, it must have been like going through deserted orchards and dead grass. My audience or future audience now would never be able to experience the newly plowed fields that I was about to enter. There were many reasons for this, reasons for the whiskey to have gone out of my bottle. Always prolific, but never exact, too many distractions had turned my musical path into a jungle of vines. I'd been following established customs, and they weren't working. The windows had been boarded up for years and covered with cobwebs, and it's not like I didn't know it. Prior to this, things had changed, and not in an abstract way. A few months earlier, something out of the ordinary had occurred, and I became aware of a certain set of dynamic principles by which my performances could be transformed. By combining certain elements of technique which ignite each other, I could shift the levels of perception, time frame structures, and systems of rhythm which would give my songs a brighter countenance, call them up from the grave, stretch out the stiffness in their bodies, and straighten them out. It was like parts of my psyche were being communicated to by angels. There was a big fire in the fireplace, and the wind was making it roar. The veil had lifted. A tornado had come into the place at Christmas time, pushed all the fake Santa Clauses aside, and swept away the rubble. That it didn't happen earlier is a damn shame. The previous 10 years had left me pretty whitewashed and wasted out professionally. Many times I'd come near the stage before a show and would catch myself thinking that I wasn't keeping my word with myself. What that word was, I couldn't exactly remember, but I knew it was back there somewhere. It's nice to be known as a legend, and people will pay to see one. But for most people, once is enough. You have to deliver the goods, not waste your time and everybody else's. I hadn't actually disappeared from the scene, but the road had narrowed, almost was shut down, and was supposed to be wide open. I hadn't gone away yet. I was lingering out on the pavement. There was a missing person inside of myself, and I needed to find him. Now and again, I did try a few times, tried hard to force it. In nature, there's a remedy for everything, and that's where I'd usually go hunting for it. I'd find myself on a houseboat, a floating mobile home, hoping to hear a voice, crawling at a slow speed, nosed up on a protective beach at night in the wilderness. Moose, bear, deer around. The elusive timber wolf not so far off. Calm summer evenings listening to the call of the loon. Think things out. But it was no use. I felt done for, an empty burned-out wreck. Too much static in my head, and I couldn't dump the stuff. Wherever I am, I'm a 60s troubadour, a folk rock relic, a wordsmith from bygone days, a fictitious head of state from a place nobody knows. I'm in the bottomless pit of cultural oblivion. You name it, I can't shake it. Stepping out of the woods, people see me coming. I knew what they were thinking. I have to take things for what they were worth. I'd been on an 18-month tour with Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers. It would be my last. I had no connection to any kind of inspiration. Whatever was there to begin with had all vanished and shrunk. Tom was at the top of his game, and I was at the bottom of mine. I couldn't overcome the odds. Everything was smashed. My own songs had become strangers to me. I didn't have the skill to touch their raw nerves, couldn't penetrate the surfaces. It wasn't my moment of history anymore. There was a hollow singing in my heart, and I couldn't wait to retire and fold the tent. One more big payday with Petty, and that would be it for me. I was what they called over the hill. If I wasn't careful, I could end up ranting and raving and shouting matches with the wall. The mirror had swung around, and I could see the future, an old actor fumbling in garbage cans outside the theater of past triumphs. I had written and recorded so many songs, but it wasn't like I was playing many of them. I think I was only up to the task of about 20 or so. The rest were too cryptic, too darkly driven. I was no longer capable of doing anything radically creative with them. It was like carrying a package of heavy, rotting meat. I couldn't understand where they came from. The glow was gone, and the match had burned right to the end. I was going through the motions. Try as I might, the engines wouldn't start. Benmont Tench, one of the musicians in Petty's band, would always be asking me, almost pleadingly, about including different numbers in the show. Chimes of Freedom, can we try that? Or what about My Back Pages? Or Spanish Harlem Incident? And I'd always be making some lame excuse. Actually, I don't know who was making the excuse, for I had closed the door on my own self. The problem was that after relying so long on instinct and intuition, both these ladies had turned into vultures and were sucking me dry. Even spontaneity had become a blind goat. My haystacks weren't tied down, and I was beginning to fear the wind. The tour with Petty was broken up into parts, and during one of the layoffs, one of the organizers, Elliot Roberts, had set up some shows for me to do with the Grateful Dead. I needed to go rehearse with the band for these shows, so I went to San Rafael to meet with the Dead. I thought it would be as easy as jumping rope. After an hour or so, it became clear to me that the band wanted to rehearse more and different songs than I had been used to doing with Petty. They wanted to run over all the songs, the ones they liked, the seldom seen ones. I found myself in a peculiar position, and I could hear the brakes screech. If I had known this to begin with, I might not have taken the dates. I had no feelings for any of those songs, and didn't know how I could sing them with any intent. A lot of them might have only been sung once anyway, the time that they'd been recorded. There were so many that I couldn't tell which was which. I might even get the words to some mixed up with others. I needed sets of lyrics to understand what they were talking about, and when I saw the lyrics, especially to the older, more obscure songs, I couldn't see how I could get this stuff off emotionally. I felt like a goon and didn't want to stick around. The whole thing might have been a mistake. I'd have to go someplace for the mentally ill and think about it. After saying that I'd left something in the hotel, I stepped back outside onto Front Street and started walking, put my head down against the drizzling rain. I wasn't planning on going back. If you have to lie, you should do it quickly and as well as you can. I started up the street. Maybe 4 or 5 or 6 blocks went by, then I heard the sounds of a jazz combo playing up ahead. Walking past the door of a tiny bar, I looked in and saw that the musicians were playing at the opposite end of the room. It was raining and there were few people inside. One of them was laughing at something. It looked like the last stop on the train to nowhere, and the air was filled with cigarette smoke. Something was calling to me to come in, and I entered. Walked along the long, narrow bar to where the Jazz Cats were playing in the back on a raised platform in front of a brick wall. I got within 4 feet of the stage and just stood there against the bar, ordered a gin and tonic, and faced the singer. An older man. He wore a mohair suit, flat cap with a little brim, and shiny necktie. The drummer had a rancher Stetson on, and the bassist and pianist were neatly dressed. They played jazz ballads, stuff like Time on My Hands and Gloomy Sunday. The singer reminded me of Billy Eckstein. He wasn't very forceful, but he didn't have to be. He was relaxed, but he sang with natural power. Suddenly and without warning, it was like the guy had opened a window to my soul. It was like he was saying, "You should do it this way." All of a sudden, I understood something faster than I ever did before. I could feel how he worked at getting his power, what he was doing to get at it. I knew where the power was coming from, and it wasn't his voice, though the voice brought me sharply back to myself. I used to do this thing, I'm thinking. It was a long time ago, and it had been automatic. No one had ever taught me. This technique was so elemental, so simple, and I'd forgotten. It was like I'd forgotten how to button my own pants. I wondered if I could still do it. I wanted at least a chance to try. If I could in any way get close to handling this technique, I could get off this marathon stunt ride. Returning to the Dead's rehearsal hall as if nothing had happened, I picked it up where we had left off. Couldn't wait to get started. Taking one of the songs that they wanted to do, seeing if I could sing it using the same method that the old singer used. I had a premonition something would happen. At first it was hard going, like drilling through a brick wall. All I did was taste the dust. But then, miraculously, something internal came unhinged. In the beginning, all I could get out was a blood-choked, coughing grunt, and it blasted up from the bottom of my lower self. But it bypassed my brain. That had never happened before. It burned, but I was awake. The scheme wasn't sewed up too tight, would need a lot of stitches, but I grasped the idea. I had to concentrate like mad because I was having to maneuver more than one stratagem at the same time. But now I knew I could perform any of these songs without them having to be restricted to the world of words. This was revelatory. I played these shows with the Dead and never had to think twice about it. Maybe they just dropped something in my drink, I can't say. But anything they wanted to do was fine with me. I had that old jazz singer to thank. I rejoined Petty for what was to be the final run of a long, drawn-out tour and told Tom's band that if they wanted to play anything, just tell me and we would do it. We started up in the Middle East on that run with 2 shows in Israel, 1 in Tel Aviv and 1 in Jerusalem, the next one in Switzerland and the next one in Italy. In these first four shows, I sang 80 different songs, never repeating one, just to see if I could do it. It seemed easy. My voice never got blown out, and I could sing forever without fatigue. Night after night, it was like I was on cruise control. I was sailing along. Then suddenly, one night in Locarno, Switzerland, at the Piazza Grande Locarno, it fell apart. For an instant, I fell into a black hole. The stage was outdoors and the wind was blowing gales, the kind of night that can blow everything away. I opened my mouth to sing and the air tightened up. Vocal presence was extinguished and nothing came out. You're in front of 30,000 people and they're staring at you and nothing's coming out. Things can really get stupid. Figuring I had nothing to lose and not needing to take any precautions, I conjured up some different type of mechanism to jumpstart the other techniques that weren't working. I just did it automatically out of thin air, cast my own spell to drive out the devil. Instantly, it was like a thoroughbred had charged through the gates. Everything came back, and it came back in multi-dimension. It left me kind of shaky. The energy was coming from 100 different angles, completely unpredictable ones. I had a new faculty, and it seemed to surpass all the other human requirements. If I ever wanted a different purpose, I had one. It was like I'd become a new performer, an unknown one in the true sense of the word. In more than 30 years of performing, I had never seen this place before, never been here. If I didn't exist, someone would have to have invented me. The shows with Petty finished up in December, and I saw that instead of being stranded somewhere at the end of the story, I was actually in the prelude to the beginning of another one. I could put my decision to retire on hold. It might be interesting to start up again, put myself in the service of the public. After the tour, I was sitting in London at the St. James Club with Elliot Roberts, who had engineered both the Petty shows and the Dead shows. I told him I needed to work 200 show dates the next year. Elliot was pragmatic, said that I should take a couple of years off and then come back. "The picture's perfect like this," he said. "Let it be." "No," I said, "it's not perfect, and I have to correct it." I poured the beer from the last bottle into two glasses and listened to him say that it might be more practical to wait at least till spring, give him more of a chance to get it together. "All right," I told him. "That's good." "I'll get you the band, too," he said. "Sure, I don't mind." I thought that was fantastic. The thought hadn't even crossed my mind that somebody else would find me the band. That would be a big weight off. I also told him that I needed to book a similar amount of shows in the same towns the following year and also the year after that. A 3-year schedule of more or less the same towns. I figured it would take me at least 3 years to get to the beginning, to find the right audience, or for the right audience to find me. The reason I thought it would take 3 years was that after the first year, a lot of the older people wouldn't be coming back, but younger fans would bring their friends the second year, so attendance would be just about equal. And in the third year, those people would also bring their friends, and it would form the nucleus of my future audience. Without knowing as much, I had a gut feeling that I had created a new genre, a style that didn't exist as of yet, and one that would be entirely my own. All the cylinders were working, and the vehicle was for hire. I definitely needed a new audience because my audience at the time had more or less grown up on my records and was past the point of accepting me as a new artist. I wished I was at least 20 years younger, wished that I had just dropped on the scene all over again. But I was going to wait until spring. I'd go home knowing that I was on the threshold of something. Maybe not as pure as heaven's rain, but something anyway, and that whatever I was on the threshold of was going to deepen as the years went on. My destiny was shining silver in the sun. Life had lost its toxic effect. I had nothing more to bitch about. Then it hit me. Returning from the emergency room with my arm entombed in plaster, I fell into a chair. Something heavy had come against me. It was like a black leopard had torn into my tattered flesh. It was plenty sore. After being on the threshold of something bold, innovative, and adventurous, I was now on the threshold of nothing. Ruined. My bright eyes were dull and I could do nothing. All I could do was groan. Here's why. Besides my devotion to a new vocal technique, something else would go along with helping me recreate my songs. It seemed that I had always accompanied myself on the guitar. I played in the casual Carter family flat-picking style, and the playing was more or less out of habit and routine. It always had been clear and readable, but didn't reflect my psyche in any way. Didn't have to. The style had been practical, but now I was going to push that away from the table too, and replace it with something more active, with more definition of presence. I didn't invent this style. It had been shown to me in the early 60s by Lonnie Johnson. Lonnie was the great jazz and blues artist from the 30s who was still performing in the 60s. Lonnie took me aside one night and showed me a style of playing based on an odd instead of even number system. He had played me chords and he demonstrated how to do it. I never used this style. Didn't see that there'd be any purpose to it. But now all of a sudden it came back to me, and I realized that this way of playing would revitalize my world. The total effect would be physiological, and triplet forms would fashion melodies at intervals. This is what would drive the song, not necessarily the lyrical content. A lot of folks would say that songs were altered, and others would say that this was the way they should have sounded in the first place. You could take your pick. Once I understood what I was doing, I realized that I wasn't the first to do it, that Link Wray had done the same thing in his classic song Rumble many years earlier. I'd also seen Martha Reeves do the same thing. I'd seen her in New York a few years earlier where she'd been playing with the Motown Review. Her band couldn't keep up with her, had no idea what she was doing, and just plodded along. She beat a tambourine in triplet form, up close to her ear, and she phrased the song as if the tambourine were her entire band. When Lonnie had showed this to me so many years earlier, it was as if he was saying something to me in a foreign language. Now it all clicked. Now I could start getting into it. My lyrics, some written as long as 20 years earlier, would now explode musicologically like an ice cloud. Nobody else played this way, and I thought of it as a new form of music, strict and orthodox. Not one thing improvisational about it. Also, you don't need to feel any certain way in order to play like this. It doesn't run on emotion. That was another good thing. I had been leaving a lot of my songs on the floor like shot rabbits for a long time. That wouldn't be happening anymore. The thing was, I needed two hands. If I couldn't play, I wouldn't be doing anything better than ever now. Nothing would be exactly right. It was noontime, and I was shuffling around in my old-fashioned garden. Cutting across the vacant lot to a bank of field flowers where my dogs and horses were, the strangled cry of a gull came whipping through the wind. Walking back to the main house, I caught a glimpse of the sea through the leafy boughs of the pines. I wasn't near it, but could feel the power beneath its colors. Seemed like a net had fallen over me, and if I'd tried to run, I'd only get more entangled. My hand had been gashed pretty good, no feeling in the nerves. Maybe it might not heal, never be the same. And the sooner I believed it, the better. Oh, the wicked ironies of life. I'd gotten a cosmic kick in the pants. I probably should have been wearing steel underwear. One night I turned on the TV and saw soul singer Joe Tex on The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson. Joe sang and left. Johnny didn't talk to him. Not like he did to the other guests. Johnny just waved to him from his desk. Carson used to like to talk to his guests about golf and things like that, but he had nothing to say to Joe. I didn't think he would have anything to say to me either. All of his guests tried to be funny, put on a happy face, not come unglued, be like Gene Kelly and go singing in the rain even during a big downpour. If I did that, I'd get pneumonia. Like Joe Tex, I'd never been much in the mainstream. I thought about how much more I was like him than like Carson. I shut the TV off. Outside, I heard a woodpecker tapping up against a tree in the dark. As long as I was alive, I was going to stay interested in something. If my hand didn't heal, what was I going to do with the remainder of my days? Not be part of the music business, that's for sure. Get as far away from it as possible. I fantasized about the business world. What could be more simple or elegant than venturing into that? It might be interesting to try the conventional life for a while. I was thinking ahead. I called a friend of mine who put me in touch with a broker who bought and sold independent businesses. Starting one from scratch was out of the question. I told him that I was thinking about selling all I had and trading for something. What do you have? He came by and brought brochures on just about every enterprise going. Facts and figures all down to the minutest detail. Self-contained businesses all over the place. Sugarcane, trucks and tractors, a wooden leg factory in North Carolina, furniture factory in Alabama, a fish farm, flower plantations and more. It was overwhelming. I wasn't too anxious to do any follow-up. I began to see less and less of the daylight. I'd lay back in a chair to rest my eyes and then 2 or 3 hours later wake up, go off to get something and forget what I went there to get. I'm glad my wife was around. At times like this, it's good if you're with someone who desires the same things as you and is open and not closed to your energy. She could make me feel like I wasn't in some godforsaken hole. One day, when she was wearing metallic sunglasses, I could see myself in miniature and thought how small everything had become. The one thing that I had no strong desire to do was to compose songs. I hadn't written anything in a long while, anyway. I had stopped doing that, just wasn't crazy for it. My last couple of record albums didn't contain many of my own compositions anyway. As far as being a songwriter went, I couldn't have had a more casual attitude. I'd written plenty that was fine. I did whatever it took to get there, had reached my goal and had no high ambitions for it, had long ceased running towards it. When and if an idea would come, I would no longer try to get in touch with the base of its power. I could easily deny it and stay clear of it, just couldn't make myself do it. I never expected to write anything ever again. Didn't need any more songs anyway. One night, when everyone was asleep and I was sitting at the kitchen table, nothing on the hillside but a shiny bed of lights, all that changed. I wrote about 20 verses for a song called Political World, and this was about the first of 20 songs that I would write in the next month or so. They came from out of the blue. Maybe I wouldn't have written them if I wasn't laid up like I was. Maybe, maybe not. They were easy to write, seemed to float downstream with the current. It's not like they'd been faint or far away. They were right there in my face. But if you looked too steady at them, they'd be gone. A song is like a dream, and you try to make it come true. They're like strange countries that you have to enter. You can write a song anywhere, in a railroad compartment, on a boat, on horseback. It helps to be moving. Sometimes people who have the greatest talent for writing songs never write any because they're not moving. I wasn't moving in any of these songs, not externally anyway. Still, I got them all down as if I was. Sometimes things you see and hear outside of yourself can influence a song. The song Political World could have been triggered by current events. There was a heated presidential race underway. You couldn't avoid hearing about it. But I had no interest in politics as an art form, so I don't think that that was all there was to it. The song is too broad. The political world in the song is more of an underworld, not the world where men live, toil, and die like men. With the song, I thought I might have broken through to something. It was like you wake up from a deep and drugged slumber and somebody strikes a little silver gong and you come to your senses. There were about twice as many verses as were later recorded. Verses like, we live in a political world, flags flying into the breeze, comes out of the blue, moves toward you, like a knife, cutting through cheese. From the far end of the kitchen, a silver beam of moonlight pierced through the leaded panes of the window illuminating the table. The song seemed to hit the wall, and I stopped writing and swayed backwards in the chair. Felt like lighting up a fine cigar and climbing into a warm bath. This was the first song I'd written in a while, and it looked like a clawish hand had written it. I knew that if I ever was to record again, I could use it. I was aware that I wasn't in the song, but that was all right. I didn't feel like being there. I put the words in a drawer, couldn't play them anyway, and snapped out of a trance. The low growl of a motorcycle rumbled up the roadway alongside the garage, and I cranked the window open wider, smelled the pomegranate blossoms blowing in a breezy fashion. I cast an embracing glance over the primordial landscape. It had been a while since I had written a song from start to finish all at once. Later in the week, we went out to see Eugene O'Neill's Long Day's Journey into Night. The play was hard to bear. Family life at its worst. Self-centered morphine addicts. I was glad when it was over. I felt sorry for these people, but none of them touched me. After that, we stopped into Harvell's, a local blues club on 4th Street, to see Guitar Shorty and J.J. Bad Boy Jones. It's always a trip seeing Shorty. He plays guitar with everything but his hands. While strolling back to the car along 4th Street, a homeless guy holding his head in his hands was being ordered to move by a couple of cops. A tiny spaniel lay at the guy's feet, the dog's beady black eyes following the nervous movements of his master. I couldn't see that the officers took any pride in what they had to do. Later that night, back at the house, I started writing the song, What Good Am I? Wrote it in a small art studio on the property. It's more than an art studio. There's arc welding equipment in there, and I'd made ornate iron gates out of junk scrap metal in the barn-like room. Most of the place has a cement floor, but there's another area covered with linoleum. There's a table there and a window with lowered blinds that looks out over a gully. The entire song came to me all at once. Don't know what could have brought it on. Maybe seeing the homeless guy, the dog, the cops, The dreary play and maybe even the antics of Guitar Shorty might have had something to do with it. Who knows? Sometimes you see things in life that make your heart turn rotten and your gut sick and nauseous, and you try to capture that feeling without naming the specifics. There were extra verses for this, too. Here's one. What good am I if I'm walking on eggs? If I'm wild with excitement and wet between the legs? If I'm right in the thick of it and I don't know why, what good am I? I put this song away in the same drawer with Political World. I wondered what they'd have to say to each other. No melodies for either. I went to sleep. My mother and my Aunt Etta were staying with us and they'd be up early, so I wanted to be up early too. The next day was overcast and a fog hung in the air. My aunt was in the kitchen and I sat down with her to talk and drink coffee. The radio was playing and the morning news was on. I started to hear that Pete Maravich, the basketball player, had collapsed on a basketball court in Pasadena, just fell over and never got up. I'd seen Maravich play in New Orleans once. He was something to see. Mop of brown hair, floppy socks, the holy terror of the basketball world, high-flying, magician of the court, scored something like 38 points. He could have played blind. Pistol Pete hadn't played professionally for a while, and he was thought of as forgotten. I hadn't forgotten about him, though. Some people seem to fade away, but then when they are truly gone, it's like they didn't fade away at all. I started and completed the song Dignity the same day I'd heard the sad news about Pistol Pete. I started writing it in the early afternoon, about the time the morning news began to wear away, and it took me the rest of the day and into the night to finish it. It's like I saw the song up in front of me and overtook it, like I saw all the characters in this song and elected to cast my fortunes with them. I have a problem sometimes remembering someone's real name, so I give them another one, something that more accurately describes them, and I had a tendency to do that throughout this song. There were more verses with other individuals in different interplays. The Green Beret, the Sorceress, Virgin Mary, the Wrong Man, Big Ben, and the Cripple and the Honky. The list could be endless. All kinds of identifiable characters that found their way into the song but somehow didn't survive. I heard the whole piece in my head. Rhythm, tempo, melody, line, the whole bit. I'd always be able to remember this song. The wind could never blow it out of my head. This song was a good thing to have. On a song like this, there's no end to things. You hold an electric torch up to someone's face and see what's there. Yet to me, it's amazingly simple. No complications. Everything pans out. One line brings up another, like when your left foot steps forward and your right drags up to it. If I had written this 10 years earlier, I'd have gone immediately into the recording studio. But a lot had changed, and I had no anxiety about that stuff anymore. Didn't feel the urge and necessity of it. I didn't feel like recording anyway. It was tedious, and I didn't like the current sounds, mine or anybody else's. I didn't think I could make a good record if I tried for 100 years. The song Disease of Conceit definitely has gospel overtones. Again, events might trigger a song. Sometimes they might start the motor. Recently, the popular Baptist preacher Jimmy Swaggart had been defrocked by the Assembly of God leadership for refusing to stop preaching. Jimmy was Jerry Lee Lewis's first cousin and was a big TV star, and the news came as a shock. He'd been linked to a prostitute, caught on camera leaving her motel room in sweatpants. Swaggart was ordered to vacate the pulpit temporarily. He wept in public and asked forgiveness, but still was told to stop preaching for a while. He couldn't help himself, though, and quickly went back to preaching as if nothing had happened and they defrocked him. The Bible is full of these things. A lot of those old kings and leaders had many wives and concubines, and Hosea the prophet was even married to a prostitute, and it didn't stop him from being a holy man. But these were different times, and for Swaggart, it was the end of the line. Reality can be overwhelming. It can also be a shadow, depending on how you look at it. As for me, I wondered what this harlot might have looked like that lured the famous preacher into rolling in the muck. A damsel of tempting statuesque beauty? Probably. It would have to be. If you paid any amount of mind to all this Mickey Mouse stuff, the way these hoity-toity people's doors and windows aren't shut tight, you might end up in a private lunatic asylum. This incident might have had something to do with inspiring the song, but then again, it's hard to say. Conceit is not necessarily a disease. It's more of a weakness. A conceited person could be set up easily and brought down accordingly. Let's face it, a conceited person has a fake sense of self-worth and inflated opinion of himself. A person like this can be controlled and manipulated completely if you know what buttons to push. So in a sense, that's what the lyrics are talking about. The song rose up until I could read the look in its eyes. In the quiet of the evening, I didn't have to hunt far for it. As always, there were a few verses left behind. There's a whole lot of people dreaming tonight about the disease of conceit. Whole lot of people screaming tonight about the disease of conceit. I'll hump you and I'll dump you and I'll blow your house down. I'll slice into your cake before I leave town. Pick a number, take a seat with the disease of conceit. I finished the lyrics and left the studio, went back to the main house. Wind was blowing through the tall bamboo. The heavy chrome bumper from my old battered Buick was shining in the moonlight. I hadn't driven that car in years, was thinking of taking it apart and using it for scrap metal sculpture. The dark gully was overgrown with brush, and there was a fox or a coyote down there. The dogs were yapping and chasing something. The lights from the main house were glittering like the inside of a casino. I went in, shut them off, and glanced at one of my guitars, which I hadn't touched in a while. I was reluctant to touch it. Might as well get some rest, I thought, and then crawled into bed. Another song, Everything is Broken, was made up of quick, choppy strokes. The semantic meaning is all in the sounds of the words. The lyrics are your dance partner. It works on a mechanical level. Everything is broken or it looks that way, chipped, cracked, in need of repair. Things are broken, then rebroken, made into something else, then broken again. Once when I was lying on the beach in Coney Island, I saw a portable radio in the sand. A beautiful General Electric, self-charging, built like a battleship, and it was broken. I could have remembered that image at the top of the song, but I had seen a lot of other things broken too. Bowls, brass lamps, vessels and jars and jugs, buildings, buses, sidewalks, trees, landscapes. All these things, when they're broken, make you feel ill at ease. I thought of all the best things in the world, the things I had a great affection for. Sometimes it might be a place, but then these places become broken too and can't be pieced back together. There's a smashing and crashing of furniture and glass. Something just breaks and gives no warning. Sometimes your dearest possession, it's beastly hard to fix anything. There were extra verses for this too. Broken strands of prairie grass, broken magnifying glass. I visited the broken orphanage and rode upon the broken bridge. I'm crossing the river, going to Hoboken. Maybe over there, things ain't broken. That was my bit of optimism to go along with a song like this. These then and some other songs I wrapped up and put them away to stay where they lay, kept them in a drawer, but I could sense their presence. In time, my hand got right and it was ironic. I stopped writing the songs. The doctor encouraged me to play my guitar, that stretching my hand was therapeutic, actually good for my hand, and I was now doing that a lot. I could begin the shows that were scheduled for me, starting in the spring, and it seemed like I was back where I began. One night, Bono, the singer from U2, was over for dinner with some other friends. Spending time with Bono was like eating dinner on a train. Feels like you're moving, going somewhere. Bono's got the soul of an ancient poet, and you have to be careful around him. He can roar till the earth shakes. He's also a closet philosopher. He brought a case of Guinness with him. We were talking about things that you talk about when you're spending winter with somebody. Talked about Jack Kerouac. He seems to know a lot about America, and what he doesn't, he's curious about. I told him that if he wants to see the birthplace of America, he should go to Alexandria, Minnesota. It was just me and Bono sitting around the table. Everyone else was scattered about. My wife came by and said she was going up to bed. "Go on up," I said. "I'm going up in a minute." It took me a while to get there, though, and the case of Guinness was almost gone. "Where's Alexandria?" Bono asked. I tell him that's where the Vikings came and settled in the 1300s. Said that there's a wooden statue of a Viking in Alexandria, and it doesn't look anything like a dignified founding father of America. He's bearded, wears a helmet, strapped knee-high boots, long dagger in a sheath, holding a spear at his side, wearing a kilt, holding a shield that says, "The Birthplace of America." Bono asked me where I was originally from, and I told him the Iron Trail, the Mesabi Iron Range. "What does Mesabi mean?" he asked. I told him it was an Ojibwa word, means land of giants. The night wore on. Out at sea, the lights of a freighter moved by every so often. Bono asked me if I had any new songs, any unrecorded ones. It just so happened that I did. I went into the other room and pulled them out of the drawer, brought them back and showed them to him. He looked them over, said I should record them. I said that I wasn't so sure about that. Thought that maybe I should pour lighter fluid over them. Said that I'd been having a hard time making records, making that work out. He said, no, no. And he brought up the name of Daniel Lanois. Said that you two had worked with him and he'd been a great partner. That he'd be perfect for me to work with. Would have much to scramble into the mix. Bono picked up the phone and dialed the man, put him on the phone with me, and we spoke for a moment. Basically, what Lanois said was that he was working out of New Orleans and told me that if I was ever there, I should look him up. I said that I would do that. To be sure, I was in no hurry to record. Performing was what was on my mind first and foremost. I had a clear road ahead, and I didn't want to blow the chance to regain my musical freedom. I needed to let things straighten out and not get mixed up anymore. It was autumn in New Orleans, and I was staying at the Marie Antoinette Hotel, sitting around by the pool in the courtyard with G.E. Smith, the guitar player in my band. I was waiting for the arrival.